Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome to the European Studies channel of the New Books Network. Today on the show, we have Kostas Lapavitsas to talk about his book, The Left's Case Against the EU, published by Polity Press in 2019. The book challenges the traditional left-wing view that the EU is a fundamentally benign project, and that if the Union shifts rightward, then the answer will be to reform it from within. Instead, Kostas argues that the response to the Eurozone crisis represents the ultimate transformation of the Union into a neoliberal institution that has austerity, privatization, and wage cuts embedded into its core. At the same time, the rise of German hegemony has divided and destabilized the Union. These developments in the EU make it impervious to meaningful reform, thus the solution is a direct challenge to the EU that stresses popular and national sovereignty as preconditions for true internationalist socialism. Kostas Lapavitsas, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I look forward to our discussion.
Great. So maybe if we could start, could you give us a short description of who you are and what you do?
I teach economics and political economy with particular specialization in the economy of Japan at the School of Oriental and African Studies in London. I've been at SOAS for a long time. I've been active in political economy of finance in terms of writing, academic and other writing for many, many years. Involved in various projects as well. Other than that, in terms of broader social and political activity, I was involved in the Greek events of the previous decade. And in 2015, I was elected to the Greek Parliament in the first wave of Syriza upsurge when he formed government. He was an MP collaborating with Syriza until they signed the third bailout of Greece with its lenders, at which point I left Syriza, continued in politics for a bit, and then left Greek politics and returned to Britain. And that's about it.
Okay, great. And could you, and why did you decide to write this book?
There are two basic reasons why I decided to write the book. The first has to do with the experience of Greece, which I've already mentioned. I was very heavily involved from 2010 onwards when the Greek debt crisis broke out. I was very heavily involved from the beginning, not so much in direct political terms, but intellectually and in terms of books and other outputs. My view at the time, argued openly, was that Greece should have defaulted on its debt. An act of sovereign default should have selected how to do it, and he should have stepped out of the euro. I believe that membership of the European Monetary Union was a tremendous mistake, a destructive mistake, and keeping the country within the Monetary Union was a guarantee of no solution, really, for its long-term development and growth problems. I argued that openly. My name became associated with this position in Greece. That's the basis on which I was elected. I argued that very strongly within Syriza, but it was not a view that prevailed. So I thought that the experience of Syriza, which I lived through and took part in, and sort of I knew firsthand, should become more widely known. I drew conclusions about the European Union. I thought they should become more widely known. The second reason is, of course, Brexit. I've lived in Britain for a very long time. Been active in British social and political life. Brexit became major news and a major political and social event in this country and in Europe soon after the Greek events. And I became involved in the discussion on Brexit, and I felt that it was imperative to put across an alternative view of Europe from the view that was coming from the British left, from the Labour Party and others. And that was a good reason for writing the book. That's why Polity asked me to write the book, and I obliged.
Okay, great. So in the book, you state that German hegemony in the EU is harmful to the Union and the European Monetary Union. Could you explain how Germany got into a leading position in the EU and how it's been harmful to the Union as a whole?
I think, first of all, that we need to establish and accept that the Union itself, certainly the Monetary Union, but also the European Union more broadly, is not characterized by convergence and a sort of equality and equal partnership of its members. I think we need to start with that, because that's a very strong ideological point, in which many, many people accept, especially those who want to defend the Union. My own position is that the Union is characterized by divergence. It's characterized by actually increasing divergence. And this divergence is marked by the creation of a core and several peripheries, not just one periphery, several peripheries. The periphery that was most evident, say, in the Eurozone crisis was the southern periphery. Spain, Portugal, Greece, and possibly Italy. But there are other peripheries as well in Central Europe, in the Baltics, and so on. These are a characteristic creation of the trajectory of the European Union. They're not accidental, and they're not leftovers. They are created by the Union. Now, when you've got peripheries, you've got a core, as I've already mentioned. And when you've got a core, you've got people and countries that lead the core, and that clearly is Germany. The hegemonic country, the most powerful country in the European Union, is Germany. And it is an interesting question and an interesting issue of how this hegemony has emerged. Before I tell you my view of this, may I say one more point?
Yeah, of course, go ahead.
Many people realize that Germany has a hegemonic position in the Union, but in public discourse, in most countries of the Union that I'm aware of, this is not admitted openly. The official position is very different. It's what I originally opened up with, that we're all converging, that we're all partners, except in Germany. The country in which you might find open acknowledgement in public debate of the hegemonic position of Germany is Germany itself. And that is not surprising, because it's characteristic of these phenomena in history that debate is more open in the country that is hegemonic. In the other countries that are not, debate is usually masked, and people pretend that things are otherwise. So for me, Germany has a hegemonic position, and the real question is why? How has this happened? I want to make two points on that. The first is of crucial importance. The hegemonic position of Germany has been reached through the European Union. It's very, very important because to say that, because people often underestimate it. For example, you can think of the international system and the world economy, and you can say that the United States still has a hegemonic position. As the world hegemonic power, the United States has helped create a set of institutions which can be understood as institutions that support its hegemonic position, from the United Nations to the IMF, the World Bank, and so on. These were created in large part by U.S. forces and U.S. intervention. That is not the case in the European Union. The European Union was created first, and German hegemony has emerged through careful management and manipulation of the mechanisms of the Union by the German state, by German power. So that's a key point about the nature of hegemony. Germany is not strong enough by itself to be hegemonic in Europe. It is hegemonic because of the European Union. Now, that's the first point. The second point on how it has emerged, this hegemonic position of Germany, is, of course, closely related to the monetary union. The euro, which was created more than 20 years ago now, was not originally a German idea. It was not proposed by Germany. It was more strongly proposed by France. It was understood as a response to German unification and all the various economic problems that had preceded that period in terms of the balance of payments and flows of funds across Europe. It was a French initiative, and the aim was fairly transparent and admitted at the time, which was basically to tie in a newly united Germany into this system and make sure that it played by the rules as they were understood by the French establishment at the time. Unfortunately, things have not worked out that way, because the euro is was designed as a pretty rigid mechanism, which helped German industry establish its preeminence in Europe in an unprecedented way, by removing the option of exchange rate changes for other countries in Europe. It basically undermined their competitiveness, and given the sustained wage repression in Germany for a very long time, from the middle of the 1990s, it gave Germany a tremendous competitive advantage. That competitive advantage emerged in the European markets, first of all, which soon became domestic markets for German big business. And then on this basis, allowed German exporting businesses to compete globally and to acquire a global position. And so what we've seen since the establishment of the euro, there's no doubt at all about it, is the emergence of an incredible surplus on current account for Germany. It's an astonishing surplus, which continues to be very, very large, based on this monetary mechanism and monetary system, which is, of course, the foundation of German economic and then political preeminence in Europe. This is where German hegemony is rooted in Europe. And in my judgment, that will remain the case for some time. It will be defended very strongly by German interests, political and economic, in the years to come.
So do you think that there's any way that this could be, the hegemonic position of Germany could be shifted so that the EU becomes less dominated by Germany?
As I mentioned already, the hegemonic position of Germany is very tightly connected and linked to the mechanisms of the EU. It derives in good measure from the existence of the EU. So whatever happens to the EU, whichever way the institutions develop now and in the years ahead, there will always be, and mostly unspoken, sometimes openly admitted, attempt to maintain power relations and hierarchy. I don't think that this will happen from within, because the mechanisms, in a sense, are dominated already by these interests from within. That doesn't mean that the EU does not change. That doesn't mean that it does not change. Of course it does change. And I think we're going through a significant period of change right now, or signaled in a variety of ways. However, this change is not in the direction in which many people on the left in particular imagine, that we're moving towards some kind of federal union, super state that will be characterized by an attempt to control markets and to support working people and to take largely Keynesian measures and policies and to support incomes and employment and so on, and control big business. That is not what's happening. The change that we're observing is not of that type. And it is actually quite strongly neoliberal still. And the bottom line is that whatever form it takes, German fundamental interests will be and are defended. There's another way of putting it, and perhaps that will help make the case clear. Again, as I've already mentioned, you can see the EU as a partnership in which various nation states of Europe have willingly taken part and given up some of their sovereignty to create a transnational entity that goes beyond the nation state, and that is good, because this transnational entity will overcome the problems and the disasters that nation states have created in Europe. It will go beyond nationalism, and therefore it will create more progressive and forward-looking reality in Europe based on soft power and so on. That's basically an argument that you hear a lot about, and you used to hear it far more than now, but nonetheless it still is common. I think that is very misleading altogether. That's not what we see. The European Union is a creation of nation states. Nation states have not gone away. They have not surrendered their sovereignty. They've created the European Union as an alliance. There is a constant arrangement of different powers within the European Union to defend their own national interests as they understand them, these interests, and a shifting network of alliances. And obviously, core countries play the dominant role in this. The nation state is there, it's doing very well, and it is very powerful in the European Union. And the most dominant position of these nation states is, of course, that of the German state, which, because of its history in the 20th century, because of the wars, because of everything that we know in Europe, has had to defend its own national interests in ways that were not really open, as open and as clear as they would have been for other nation states. And that continues. That hasn't gone away. That is basically how the European Union works, even if it changes, and it is changing at the moment. The bottom line is still that hierarchy is maintained and German hegemonic power in a constant tussle with French power is present in the European Union, and so it will be.
Okay, so I think we should move on from this topic. And my next question is, how do you think that the Eurozone crisis of 2010 and the financial crisis in 2007 to 9 have affected the EU and the European Monetary Union?
I think that's a crucial question. I think that's a crucial question, and I think we're living through the impact of those events right now, and we can see them very clearly in the coronavirus crisis that came 10 years later. But if we look at the global crisis of 2007-2009, and then the Eurozone crisis that followed it, a number of things became very clear. First of all, that whatever else happened, the interests of lender countries and the big institutions of the Union that had basically cooperated with lender countries should be defended. For me, the Greek events, but also the experience of Portugal, the experience of Spain and other countries at the time were of decisive importance. It became very clear that the European Union was structured and managed by institutions and an approach that was thoroughly well sort of hardened in the interests of lenders, in the interests of big business. The deal that was imposed on Greece, for instance, the way that the Syriza government was confronted by the massed ranks of European institutions was absolutely revealing. No concessions were made. Any alternative view was opposed and destroyed. And it became very clear that at the core of it, the European Union had the neoliberal practices. It was he believed in austerity, and he was out first and foremost to defend the interests of big business rather than poorer countries and working people. That, to me, was clear. At the same time, however, there was no denying that the rigidity of the monetary union, the inability of the euro to serve the interests even of big business of other countries. It served the interests of German big business very well, but less well the interests of French big business or Italian big business or the Italian economy, the Spanish economy as a whole. It served them far less well. The inability of the euro to adjust and to confront its own weaknesses and to transform itself structurally was also very revealing, because it was causing it was raising the prospect of collapse, and I was quite astonished to observe that the European Union was not capable of formally changing those structures during that time. What it was not formally capable of doing, however, it began doing informally. And that's what's important. The European Union has transformed itself informally, and especially the monetary union, in a very sustained way during the last 10 years. The first and most important change has to do with the European Central Bank. The attitude of the European Central Bank back in 2010 and 2011 was very hard and inadequate for the crisis that Europe was facing at the time. It did not act as a central bank of its time. It did not act in the way in which the Federal Reserve System did in the United States. It was not capable of dealing with the crisis. It was actually making it worse, particularly because it could not create liquidity freely and easily to assuage the pressures in the financial markets. Part of this was connected to the no bailout rule under which the union operated, which acted as a brake on the European Central Bank. Well, the Eurozone crisis began a process whereby the no bailout rule was suspended, or if made without content, and the European Central Bank was transformed. Once Mario Draghi took over, the change became far more established, and it became very clear that the European Central Bank began to operate differently, and it began to provide liquidity far more freely through the acquisition of government paper, even in the secondary markets, but in huge amounts. The provision of liquidity then began to resemble that of other central banks. The European Central Bank changed, and we saw that transformation in the coronavirus crisis. The ability of the ECB to respond and respond massively through its pandemic program has its roots in the change that began in the Eurozone crisis. So that's the first change, which is of paramount importance. But then, as that became bigger and bigger, and it became clear that the Eurozone was not functioning like before, it was acquiring elements of discretion, other things began to emerge slowly, which then became evident when coronavirus struck. So what we saw was the suspension of the Stability and Growth Pact. Now, the Stability and Growth Pact was the cornerstone of the monetary union. It provided fiscal discipline, and it was almost a law in ideological terms in the monetary union. Well, that's been suspended in one go. At the same time as that was suspended, what we also saw was the suspension of regulations on state aid, the provision of state aid, and the management of competition. Until very recently, until March this year, essentially, state aid rules in the European Union were rigid, harder than world trade rules, And basically, the aim was to allow for a level playing field, presumably, but in effect acted as mechanisms to prevent state intervention in the economy. Well, that's been lifted. It's been lifted, and state aid the last few months has been enormous, particularly in Germany. And finally, what we've seen the last few weeks with the adoption of the new generation EU new generation plan of the Commission, where we see substantial fiscal transfers. They're not as big as people make out, but they're substantial, based on borrowing undertaken by the Commission. In other words, some kind of joint borrowing, not quite Eurobonds, but some kind of joint borrowing. Now, that, again, is a tremendous change. If you put all these changes together, you will now see that the European Union has become even more openly an alliance of states operating on the basis of discretion, not rules, in which shifting alliances of states with the hegemonic states in the center dictate the pattern of events and the behavior of the Union as a whole. That's what's happening, in my judgment, and that is the outcome in the longer term of the crisis of the Eurozone and the 10 years that followed in the ways that are summed up for you.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and
asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Okay, so how do you think they could have responded to both the Eurozone crisis and the financial crisis? Like, what would how would you respond to them?
When the crisis broke out in Europe, right? When the 2010 crisis broke out in Europe, and that was basically a continuation of the global crisis 2007-2009. When that crisis broke out, the Eurozone crisis, my own personal expectation was surely the decision-making powers of the Union will realize that ultimately the problem has to do with the euro. It has to do with the monetary mechanism, which is clearly dysfunctional, which does not allow for an adjustment of competitive power and favors German competitiveness because Germany has followed the policy of wage rigidity and keeping its inflation low. I thought surely they would see that, and surely there would be some kind of policy whereby the adjustment would be, in a sense, equitably shared between the member states. In other words, Germany would be asked to make some concessions itself, not just the southern states in terms of adjusting to its own competitiveness. So I thought that Germany would be asked to make some concessions there. And then I also thought that perhaps we will see some kind of structural change of the way the monetary union worked, allowing for greater flexibility. Nothing happened of that nature. Nothing. The burden was shifted onto the southern periphery. No change was imposed. No demands for change were imposed on the countries of the core. The pain was shifted entirely onto the periphery, and the situation became even more untenable than before. It became very clear that this was stabilization without the prospect of growth. The European Union stabilized the South through poverty and through social suffering, basically, without giving it the prospect of growth, because, of course, the monetary union had not changed, did not change structurally. So that's what I expected, and that's what should have happened in a way, if this was a genuine partnership of countries. There's no doubt that Greece had mishandled its finances and its trade arrangements. There is no doubt that Spain and Italy and sorry in Ireland had gone through enormous credit bubbles, pivoting on real estate, and therefore they had to take some action to correct that and some pain as a result of that. But by God, they were not the only countries that had actually mishandled their economy. The German economy was itself very badly warped, having gone through tremendous austerity domestically, a tremendous loss of income for working people in Germany, a worsening of infrastructure, lack of investment, and that counterbalanced by tremendous exports. So I thought, yeah, surely Germany would also have to rebalance. Well, it didn't. It should have done, but it didn't. That, to me, was a lesson. It was a lesson, and it made me look at the European Union in a very different way, and that's why I wrote my book. And I think that this gives you also insight into what's happening now. the union is changing, but it's not changing by restructuring itself in the way that people imagine. It is changing in this sort of gradual, cumulative, unplanned way, and the end result will be more competition among nations and more competition among states, in which hegemonic nations will win in the end, as always.
Okay, so I think I would like to go to a sort of different topic now, which is to touch on democracy in the EU. I think it is in chapter 6 you talk about this of your book. So in general, could you go into what your view is on the EU being a democratic organization and maybe how the Eurozone crisis may have affected EU democracy?
The EU makes a lot of noise and projects itself ideologically as a very democratic institution that relies on soft power. A minute's consideration, particularly if you look at the EU from the outside, is enough to show you that that's not the case. Actually, the system itself is very strongly undemocratic and anti-democratic in many ways. It seems to me that democracy is of crucial importance for a variety of reasons, also for economic performance. Democracy is fundamental. The question is, what do we understand by democracy and how we approach it? Now, even in electoral terms, I don't think there's any doubt that the EU is not sufficiently democratic. All you've got to do is go over the mechanisms of European elections and see how the European Commission appoints its chairperson. This mechanism was established in this particular case, the Spitzenkandidaten mechanism, trying to instill a modicum of democracy in it. Countries went through this complicated rigmarole, and when in the end the representatives of powerful nations could not agree, they simply appointed the current incumbent, bypassing their own system. So there is no democratic process at the level of the European Union that is comparable to national democratic processes. That cannot be repeated enough. People get very confused. Because there are elections for the European Union, it is easy to imagine that somehow this entity out there is created through democratic processes such as we have in most other countries in Europe. It's not. That's not the case. Democracy, insofar as it exists in Europe, is always and invariably at the national level. And at the national level, it exists in a complex way, which involves elections, which involves accountability and controls over the executive power, and which, of course, involves checks and balances on the judiciary. These are the standard principles of, democracy as we've known it for more than two centuries now. Well, they don't hold at the level of the European Union. They hold at the level of nation states, not at the level of the European Union. There, what you get is basically horse trading, appointment and bypassing of accountability. You can see it at the level of the European Central Bank, for instance. You can see it at the level of several other institutions, including the Commission. But the most obvious instance of this bypassing of democracy is, of course, at the level of the European Court of Justice. Because the European Court of Justice is this historically incredibly strange institution created by nation states, but apparently detached from nation states. An institution that exists somewhere in hanging in the spaces between nations and states, not obviously subject to any kind of accountability processes, drawing on and creating European law, which is supposed to be superior to national law, and over which there are no popular controls. Only Europe could create that. It's a Frankenstein. It's a complete Frankenstein that denies the basic principle of democracy, which is that laws must be made through a process that is accountable to the people, through a process that expresses popular sovereignty. Well, the European Court of Justice is not based on popular sovereignty in any sense. And to me, this is evidence of powers in Europe that basically bypass democratic processes, bypass sovereign rights, and serve other interests, and in this case, big business interests, because the European Court of Justice, in the end of the day, acts as defender of neoliberal policies and as defender of neoliberal practices. So democracy is crucial, and the critique of the European Union and the opposition to the European Union is a matter of democracy as well as a matter of organizing the economic and social affairs of Europe differently. Now, I understand that there's a big debate about sovereignty, what it means, and is the nation state the best defender of democratic rights and of sovereignty and so on. I am not a defender of the nation state per se. I understand that this history in Europe has been very mixed and terrible at times. But I would like to look at reality, and I would like to use historical experience as my guide. To go back to the Greek events that I mentioned to you before, the Syriza events that I mentioned to you before, we had a government that was elected, popularly elected, and expressed the democratic wish of the Greek people for certain actions. It was thwarted. It was not able to do anything, any of the things that the Greek people voted for, because it was opposed by the mechanisms of the European Union. And ultimately, behind those lay the European Central Bank and, of course, the European Court of Justice in the last instance. There was no element of popular sovereignty that I could see. And in my judgment, that is what is needed in Europe. A reassertion of popular sovereignty, a sense of belonging, and a sense of being able to control political and other institutions in the way in which the people want. At the moment, there is none of that in Europe. None of that. And that is the root of political malaise in Europe, if you ask me.
So if I understand you correctly, you're generally... you're supporting a shift towards a less integrated union where they still trade with each other, but they generally the union is not it's not as integrated, and that would be the way to solve this problem of the union not being democratic. Do I understand you correctly?
You're definitely putting your finger on important issues here, and you give me an opportunity to say a few more things about it. In terms of what needs doing for democracy and transformation of the union, of paramount importance is the sidelining, the abolition and sidelining of the monetary union in the first place. Europe does not need a common currency, and it does not need a central bank that is accountable to no one. Europe doesn't need that. And it doesn't need it not only economically, but also in democratic terms. People typically do not appreciate the power of money, not just in economic terms, but also in social and political terms. The emergence of the common currency in Europe has accelerated enormously the move of Europe away from democracy. It made accountability much less prominent in Europe by creating all these institutions that are concerned with defending the monetary union in the first and foremost. So Europe does not need all that. If it wishes to have democracy, it should move away from these very powerful transnational institutions to do with money and reestablish monetary sovereignty. Now, obviously, I'm not advocating competitive alignment of exchange rates and free market determination of exchange rates in Europe, but there are many other ways in which international transactions among European nations, commodity transactions, and capital flows can be managed in an equitable way in the absence of a common currency. You don't need a common currency for that. So I would argue that that's a key transformation that Europe needs that will improve democracy as well. Now, more broadly, Europe needs to confront head-on the relationship between European law and national law. The idea that European law predominates and other things equal, countries should make their own national law consistent and coherent with European law is deeply problematic to me, deeply problematic. I understand how national law is determined. I was a member of parliament. I saw the lawmaking process at first hand. It's not ideal, far from it. It has many, many problems. To be sure, parliaments do. But at least there's a process of electing people, controlling what happens, accountability, and so on. There is no such process in Europe. No such process at all. Until and unless the relationship between European law and national law is put on a better foundation, democracy will suffer in Europe for sure. So that is also what needs looking into strongly. The third thing that I would point out is, of course, all those mechanisms in Brussels, including the European Parliament, the Commission, that huge array of bureaucrats and others, possibly 50,000 people, something like that, between 30 and 50,000 people in Brussels who are usually well-paid and have all kinds of privileges in Brussels. Their role in any kind of democratic process in Europe is not obvious to me, not obvious at all. And that also has to be straightened out, and that also has to be managed and reconsidered. In other words, what I'm saying is, the nation states, which are present, and they haven't gone away, they are the dominant players in Europe, should admit that they are the dominant players. Better structures of sovereign control should be established, popular sovereign control should be established within nation states, and better relations should emerge among nation states, independent of the current arrangements, separate from the current arrangements of the European Union. It's a big and long ask, I know. But then Europe is a continent, a very well-off continent with millions of people. So it wouldn't be a simple solution, no matter what.
Okay, so I would like to shift now to the topic of Brexit and get your opinion on how you think that Britain leaving the European Union will affect the union long term. And if you think there may be an opportunity in this for the EU to start reforming?
Well, Brexit is important for the trajectory of the Union, undoubtedly. And its impact on the Union will become clearer only in the longer term. Many of the changes that I already mentioned to you that are taking place in the Union, the lifting of the suspension of the Stability and Growth Pact, the suspension of state aid regulations, the adoption of some kind of fiscal transfer mechanisms, modest as they are, but nonetheless they're there. All these things that have taken place the last little while, indicating the transformation of the union, the preceding transformation of the union, are also connected to Brexit. Brexit was a major shock for the union because Britain is, of course, a very powerful European country. It was not a founding member of the European Union, but nonetheless played a crucial role. And its exit is historically very important for a number of reasons. Coronavirus has muddied the water a bit and made us forget Brexit for a bit, but its importance is there and it will become clearer again in the near future. Now, why did Britain exit? What is it that led to Brexit? Now, we can cut to the main point quickly and say that the policy that the British state had historically adopted towards the European Union since its entry, a policy that we could describe as semi-detachment. In other words, we participate. We are a net contributor to the budget. But at the same time, we maintain our right to ask for exemptions, not to comply with certain regulations and rules that we think do not fit and match our national interest. That policy came to an end around about 2016 with David Cameron as the Prime Minister. And it came to an end in the context of the Eurozone crisis, as the European Union was itself transforming the way it acted, but mostly because Britain realized that in that context of the changing European Union, it could not defend its national interest in the same way. The ability to say that we want exemptions and we will get them had basically evaporated. David Cameron asked for exemptions regarding the free movement of labor, didn't get them, and it became clear that the strategy of Britain for many decades with regard to the European Union had come to an end. So Britain had to devise a different strategy for itself. It wasn't clear what was that going to be. There was a big debate within the British ruling elite on how to structure that new position towards the European Union. And in that context, David Cameron made a mistake, made the political mistake, and called for a referendum, allowed the referendum to proceed. Now, the referendum that decided in favor of exit was not directly on the European Union itself. A lot of people in Britain simply did not understand what the European Union is or does. And that is not just Britain, incidentally. Many people in Europe don't understand it. They voted, though, for exit because they wanted to protest. Because they wanted to protest against everything that had happened the last several years, the inequality, the lack of direction, the evident problems that society and economy faced in Britain for many, many years, and they wanted to protest against those. And the people they associated with these policies were people who were advocating membership, strong membership. So if you wanted to protest against these policies, you voted against the European Union because those people you associated with those policies supported the European Union. So British people voted no. After that, it became a matter of democracy. And there we saw again the democratic deficit of the European Union and those who support the European Union, because what took place after that referendum was a sustained effort on the part of the pro-EU forces in Britain, but also the EU bureaucracy to overturn the British referendum. Extraordinary things took place, which I witnessed firsthand, and that's why I also wrote my book. Extraordinary things. I mean, unbelievable things took place, attempting to overturn the clearly expressed the desire, democratic will of the British people. And in other countries, this might have worked. In Britain, it wouldn't. And it was obvious to me that it wouldn't. If you know the history of Britain, then you should have realized that was the wrong thing to do. It was the wrong thing to do because British working people and others might have 1,000 weaknesses in terms of their own understanding of history, culture, and so on. But democracy, they take seriously. And their vote, they take very seriously. And all efforts to undermine their vote were obvious to them. And it made them ever more determined to continue saying no. That was, of course, mixed and muddied with outright racism, it has to be said. Anti-immigrant feeling, racism, and so on. Those who took advantage of it were, of course, forces of the extreme right in Britain associated the European Union with the immigration and wanted to exit on the basis of essentially anti-immigrant rhetoric and anti-immigrant prejudice. This was very, very unfortunate. History moves in these unfortunate ways. And it was also largely because the British left, much like the rest of the European left, instead of taking a constructively critical view of the European Union and a constructively positive view of the referendum, effectively, and the referendum result for exit, effectively tried itself to undermine it. And it did not put arguments across that could have allowed the British people to see that actually immigrants are not the problem and racism is not the solution for anything. But then such is life, and so do politics move. The bottom line is that the attempt to undermine the referendum could never have worked in this country. It didn't. To us who live here and who experienced the attitude of working class and other voters on these issues, it was perfectly obvious that that even if there was a second referendum, the vote would again have been no. It might even have been stronger. The no vote might even have been stronger. So Brexit made all these things very clear. And in the domestic context, finally, in Britain, Brexit was the reason why we have the Conservative government that we have. The section of the Conservative Party that understood this and understood the need to position Britain differently in the EU and understood the need to placate working people in Britain won. They came out with a message of different policies pivoting on the nation state, policies pivoting on expenditure, policies pivoting on intervention, and policies that would be directly open to the democratic will of the British people. And guess what? They won. Now, I don't trust them and I don't support them, but I recognize what they did. Whereas much of the left in Britain was confused, did not put across clear arguments, and it got destroyed effectively. And that's where we are.
Okay, so I would like to finish up with just asking, where do you see the future of the European Union? And do you think that this will be a positive one or a negative one in light of the pandemic and Brexit and all these transformative events that are happening at the moment?
The European Union, and especially the monetary union, has shown its ability to survive. That has to be factored in. The ability of the euro to survive the crisis of the previous decade is astonishing. And indicates that major forces will move behind it to prevent its collapse, no matter what, as they have done in the course of the coronavirus crisis. Because you see, when coronavirus hit, it was immediately a threat for the euro and acknowledged as such. It was immediately a threat for the euro because the regulations of the monetary union were preventing the southern periphery from taking key steps to protect their economies. Tensions quickly emerged, and it became clear that politically the monetary union was becoming untenable. So the reaction by the Commission and other forces within the European Union was actually a reaction to the threat to the euro. I have to say, it is in historical terms, it is actually quite strange and funny in a way. The euro was created as a currency and a set of institutions that would presumably make Europe stronger, that it would take it forward, that it would actually make it better founded. In practice, as we've seen, it is the first point of weakness. And far from the euro actually helping Europe confront shocks, the rest of Europe has to mobilize to defend the euro whenever a shock emerges. It's like it is the horse being the cart being placed before the horse here. But anyway, to go back to what I was saying, there is no doubt that the euro will be protected, and it will be protected by the powers that be, because of course it serves key interests, and the fundamental interests it serves are those of German industry, German big business, that is very worried about what might happen if the euro collapses. So I don't expect the euro to disappear soon, but I do expect the monetary union to behave differently to before. I've already outlined how that is. From a state of rules, from being a monetary union operating on the basis of pretty rigid rules, gradually it has become a monetary union that operates on the basis of discretion, or good proportion, good dose of discretion, serving, of course, still the interests of hegemonic powers. That is an important transformation of the monetary union. And that, I think, points to what might happen to the European Union as a whole. Far from it becoming a super state or a federal union or the other fantasies that that people often have, which are pure fantasies because there cannot be such a state in Europe, and there should not be such a state in Europe if one values democracy. Far from that, the European Union is moving towards becoming a set of institutions within which nation states compete more openly and ally themselves against each other more openly. I expect it to continue that way. I expect it to keep moving that way. I don't think it will go out of existence. Too many interests are tied up, even with the European Union itself. It will be a framework within which economic and political life will take place in Europe, and I expect it to change pragmatically and sort of functionally as things move along. Within that, I think that the role of the nation state will become more and more powerful. The nation state has demonstrated its enormous power in the context of the coronavirus crisis. It has been the main lever of intervention. It controlled markets, it provided liquidity, it stopped social life by imposing lockdowns. It has shown that economic and social life moves around it. And that's how it's going to be in Europe, and the European Union will adapt to it. So the period of the grand words and the big ideological promises of a transnational entity that will move towards a federal existence, and it will transcend the nation state. That's coming to an end. That's finished practically. That's how I see the European Union moving. That's what I think it will be. And in that way, it can maintain itself for quite some time. Institutions in history don't often cease to exist. They become something else. They lose their content. It becomes something else. A name is maintained, but the function is quite different. And I think that's what's going to happen to the European Union in the years ahead.
Okay. Well, unfortunately, the time is up. We have to bring the podcast to a close. I'd like to thank you for the fascinating read and the fascinating conversation. And thank you for appearing on the European Studies channel of the New Books Network podcast.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure talking to you. And I hope it's useful to you.
Okay. And lastly, thank you to the listener for listening.